Anyway, I was asking you, as far as your own work, either in collecting or developing what you've collected into publications, what do you think is probably what you would consider your most important work?
Well, folklore has been a sort of pet avocation of mine. It hasn't been my vocation. If all had been right with the world, I might have stuck to folklore and song and dance, so to speak. But I decided that there was too much wrong out there to give that much time to it, so I got over into political science and other such things, so that my writing moved off in that direction, often illustrating with folk materials, however. So that I wouldn't know how to judge anything I'd done in the area of folklore. I'm glad we got out when we did and canned what we could.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in terms of, I know you did a lot of work crusading against the Ku Klux Klan and other such racist activities. And in a way, that the Ku Klux Klan and those kinds of attitudes are kind of a negative aspect of folklore. And that not all folklore is good. And not all folklore probably should be preserved, if you know what I mean.
I just got through writing that in so many words almost.
Oh, really?
This week, yes. I was dealing with the general subject of tradition and what constitutes a traditional people, and that tradition, too, if it wants to survive, had better keep growing and not become static. And I made the same point you just did, that error has a way of getting caught up in tradition as well as the truth, and the Klan would be a good example of that happening. Mm-hmm. The Klan certainly is a traditional Southern institution, so forth.
Right. And it relies a lot on people's fear and superstition and attitudes, stereotypic attitudes that are part of folklore, and unfortunately that's all a kind of a negative side of it. While there's a lot that's wonderful and should be preserved, there are some things that shouldn't be. Maybe be less than best if they evolve into something else.
The Nazis are another bad example of tradition being misused and resorting to their tribal war gods to get people excited. I don't know what the democratic answer to that kind of tradition is. That's one reason I moved into politics from the folklore, to try to find answers. Mm-hmm. And I think it consists mainly of if people live together in a certain fashion, then that gives rise to a lore and tradition which reflects the good neighborly thing. Whereas as long as we're at each other's throats, that comes out in folk songs and things too.
Mm-hmm. When you, getting back to your life experience, when the Writers Project ended and I guess Palmetto Country had already been published, then what did you do from there? Did you go into full-time writing? Or?
Seems to me I took a job with the CIO Political Action Committee. The CIO was separate from the AFL in those days. It had just begun, and they were organizing the entire country on an industry-wide basis rather than crafts, and were making a special effort to organize Southern workers who were largely unorganized. And they called it Operation Dixie and set up a staff based in Atlanta, and I was serving as Southeastern editorial director, producing materials for the organizing and things like that, newspaper and pamphlets.
Did your folklore background help you in that kind of work?
Yes, we had a scheme that, which consisted of, the theory that the Southern industrial worker and most of the South industrial workers were right in from the farm and textile and whatever else we had in those days, and very much rural come to town, mill towns. And my assumption was, based upon experience, that the language they were speaking was pretty much pure Anglo-Saxon. Not necessarily four-letter words, but Anglo-Saxon anyway. And too many of the union organizing materials and writers from up north were using Latin derivatives and things which were foreign to people we were trying to address. So I made a rule for myself and others on the staff to try to write pure Anglo-Saxon. There were to be no Latin derivatives in what we produced. So we turned out all sorts of things about voting rights and civil rights and the benefits of organizing and so on in this Anglo-Saxon tongue. Hmm. So
that's really interesting. I guess I hadn't thought of that. You're probably right.
Well, I think Latin was long the language of government in England itself, and it's just a we-they sort of thing that we wanted to get away from.
Sure, yeah.
Lawyers and insurance people, people who write and draw up contracts for you to sign, you know, write it in Latin so they can rob you with a fountain pen. Woody Guthrie's line.
Right.
Through this world I've rambled, met lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six-gun, some with a fountain pen.
Did you know Woody Guthrie back in those days? Or?
He spent a lot of time right here, yes. He had seen Palmetto Country, and we struck up a correspondence. And on a trip to New York, I met him, and then he came down here and stayed sort of indefinite periods. Of course, moved around a great deal, and I was just—he had never been to Florida. I think at that time he'd been in every state in the union except Florida. So,
would he help you with your organizing, with your in Atlanta, or was this?
That's really how we got together in these organizing drives. Woody would pop into town when a strike was in progress and whatnot. He and Pete Seeger sometimes together, and Cisco Houston and other people. And they would do the singing, and I would do the talking about the Klan and unionism, things like that. Mm-hmm. So we did appear on platform together a lot. Yeah,
yeah, was he married at the time that you know him? Or?
You can never tell about Woody. he had a long-haired girl from California. that he brought with him, and I think they eventually got married when he was here the last time. Very, very sweet gal.
Uh-huh. I know reading some biographies of him, it did say that was the one problem with him was that he couldn't be tied down, and when he was married, his wife would see him maybe one day out of the month, and then he'd be gone again doing his organizing and everything, and he did get around quite a bit in those days.
Really, really unpredictable, his movements. See, I recall one time we were having a party in Greenwich Village, and he just suddenly said, "Well, see you all later. Where are you going?" "I'm California." So walked out the door. The next night, I think the party was still going on. Here comes Woody ringing, rang the doorbell. He said, "I thought you were going to California." He said, "Well, got my coast mixed." He was still there.
Did you want to ask some questions while I'm at a, okay, interject whenever you want to. If you want to ask some questions to Landon, I know Landon's a musician, that's why, and Doris is also a musician. Mm. I was wondering if they wanted to interject at this point, about your, when, I think I read in that article about you that, did you actually, in order to investigate the Klan, actually go undercover
Yeah, I had to establish another identity and took the name of John S. Perkins and got a job with a hate sheet in Birmingham and had credentials from that hate sheet and did most of my undercover work under that name.
Well, were you working for the government to do this, or just yourself, or?
I started out working for myself. This was during the war, and they wouldn't let me go. That is, everyone else was fighting Nazis, so I had a back problem and didn't get into service. So I decided I'd, you know, fight Kluxers instead of Nazis. So I did that, and eventually the Anti-Defamation League picked up on it, and I worked with Drew Pearson, the Jack Anderson's predecessor, the Washington merry-go-round for a while. I would phone him the minutes of the Klan's last meeting, and he'd read off the names of all the politicians and so on who were at the meeting. So we had a lot of fun. He had a Sunday night broadcast. The Klan met on Saturday night.
Well, that's...
The FBI, I offered them the information, and the next thing I knew, the Grand Dragon was making a little speech at the meeting saying, "Yeah, I had a little call from the FBI last week. Said they warned me to be on the lookout. They said we've been infiltrated. Said you can't ask for better cooperation than that, can you, boys?"
You know, wow.
I was afraid they'd given them my name along with all the rest of it, or a description. Oh. But apparently it didn't go that far. They just warned him to be careful. I've had that same experience in decades of dealing with the FBI on the subject of the Klan. They would pretend to listen, would not take notes. I'm sure it had their recorders turned off, but would then lead me out into the hall and start whispering about, "Didn't I know something? I mean, what did I know about Martin Luther King, for example?" But that's where the real problem is, you know.
It's like, which side are you, are they on?
Yeah. In those days, of course, they had no blacks in the FBI at all. Mm-hmm. And not a whole lot now.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, that's, were you ever afraid for your life? I mean, those people are not nice people.
The Dragon had a standard thing of saying Kennedy's ass is worth $1,000 a pound FOB Atlanta. That's the way he put it. Talk about standing me up in front of the altar and wear off both of his arms up to the elbow, you know, beating on me again. Things like that. One time he said, "The bald-headed bastard sitting right here tonight." And I looked around in the herd to see how many bald-headed bastards there were in the clavern, and there were six or seven anyway. But that made me sweat a little.
Yeah.
He was just bluffing, apparently.
Oh, gosh.
Hoping you'd stand up and run out the door.
I guess. Right?
Then he'd know the next time he was there. Yeah. Yeah. But, to get back to the, to folklore.
Yeah.
Of course, that is, as we said, all folklore. Yeah. I know there have been several authors who have written in Florida who have used folk materials. When you were writing Palmetto Country, you had mentioned this was going to be a series of books, and you were, I suppose, hired to do the Florida portion of a nationwide series.
Right.
What was the thrust of the series? Did it have a main emphasis?
Or? Caldwell frankly admitted to me that he didn't know what the thrust was going to be. He was going to just let the authors do their own thing. And I argued with him and the publishers that, you know, it really shouldn't be quite that free-handed. Mm-hmm. And so they finally agreed, and it finally ended up fairly structured. There was enough flexibility as it was. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably a pretty valuable series in terms of reflecting that period.
Does and also the folklore that was available at that time.
Yeah, it tied in with the that other series, American Rivers series, and somewhat similar.
Mm-hmm. Did you were you at the time you were writing? Were you familiar with any of the other Florida authors that used folk materials in their writing?
Marjorie Kennan Rawlings was. I saw a good bit of her. My next-door neighbor, Mrs. Frances Yule, who was one of the administrators of the Florida White Collar Projects, as a matter of fact, and who had gotten me my job, really. I was a good personal friend of Marjorie Rawlings. And she spent quite a lot of time there and cooking her Cross Creek recipes and things. So I saw her to that extent. I know that she spent her first royalty check on lingerie in Jacksonville.
Which would have been a real luxury.
Thousands of dollars, yes. Came rushing up from Cross Creek and spent it all on lingerie.
She never worked for the Writers Project, though, did she?
No.
I don't think so. No. She had already, had she already published by that time?
Yes. She'd
been working.
Yes. There was a fellow we had on staff named Raymond E.F. Larson. And he never achieved much fame except in Catholic literary circles. He was a poet. And he had problems, psychological problems. And he heard voices and so on. But he, as a poet, he, in my opinion, he was an important poet. But he wrote on religious themes only, and including a volume called Saints at Prayer. And this was, a lot of it was done in Florida. I don't think anyone knows about him.
No, I've never heard of him. Is he still alive? Or
you would be having a cup of tea with him in a cafe, and he'd say, "Do you hear what that waitress said?" I said, "No, what'd she say?" She said, "Hello, Larson." And the waitress hadn't said anything. But the fellow had trouble.
Yeah. Did you knew, I think you mentioned that you knew Lillian Smith.
What did she do in Florida?
She wrote two books. She supposedly, now, she's dead now, but she lived over in Jasper in our county, Hamilton County.
How long?
Quite a few years, from what I understand. She well, she traveled around. She would also be up in Atlanta and whatever.
What years do you know in Florida?
I wish I did. I'm not real sure. Do you know what years she lived there?
She was in the Georgia Mountains with Paula Snelling, and they wrote, they had a magazine called South Today, a quarterly. And she was probably, she was ahead of me, I think, as a white Southerner calling for total equality in print.
She wrote a book called Strange Fruit.
Yes.
And supposedly she based a lot of her characters on people she knew in Jasper, and it caused quite a stir. In fact, for a while they ran her out of town, I guess, because, which, you know, it was very, her ideas were very progressive for the
Strange
time.
Strange Fruit appeared at the same time as my second book, which was Southern Exposure.
Yeah.
And reviewers were reviewing them jointly, for example. And I recall Senator Bilbo. I don't know, you're too young to know about Bilbo of Mississippi, but he was the leading loudmouth exponent of white supremacy in the Senate, and filled the Senate record with, you know, books of racist bile. And he eventually got cancer of the throat, and there was a news story to the effect that from his deathbed he called in reporters and read to them extracts from Lillian Smith's Strange Fruit and My Southern Exposure, and said, this is what the South is up against, and these people want to cut my throat horizontally, whereas the doctors are just going to cut it vertically. You know, he had cancer of the larynx. But
although, you know, it's interesting, you just said, well, we're too young to know about Bilbo. The name Bilbo has become synonymous with a real bimbo.
Yeah.
And I think probably from his time. So actually the folklore of Senator Bilbo lives on. And
well, Strom Thurmond, of course, is another one with that sort of tradition in his background.
He's still alive and well.
Yeah, I'm trying to recall about Lillian Smith. We corresponded a lot, and I saw her occasionally, but and I used some things of hers in some of my books with her permission, but I you know, I didn't know her that well, but she certainly was one of the first to you know, draw no lines.
And she also used the folk idiom and folklore mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. illustrate.
That's true.
Her points.
True.
As well as Marjorie Kennan Rawlings, as far as her illustrating, I guess, the beauty of a rural frontier almost existence yeah. in Florida, and then of course Zora Neale Hurston drew a lot on folklore for her work, and those there's one other author who I can think of off the top of my head who lived and worked in Florida who used folklore, and that's Gloria Jehoda.
I've read her book, and not so strange. I had toyed with the notion of doing something called Back Roads to Florida some years before she finally did it, you know. Uh-huh. What was her title?
The Other Florida.
The Other Florida.
Yeah.
And I should have done it.
Yeah.
She did a good book.
I know. She just recently died, as a matter of fact. We were going to interview her. She died last year also, along with
Hurston, I had quite a bit of manuscript and correspondence from her, which I might mention. I turned over to the Hurston collection at Gainesville, at the library. So it's there, including some what you might call hanky head letters to Dr. Course. Course apparently commissioned her to go to Washington and cut out all the lynchings and things like that from the Florida guidebook before it went to press, and they thought that being black, Zora could just say, well, that's not true, which is what she tried to do. But they brought some blacks in on the national level to stand her down, you know, Dr. Du Bois and Sterling Brown, some really big people. And she tried, though, to get the lynchings out of the Florida Guide. Huh. Lied, saying she was there, eyewitness, things like that. She wasn't at all.
Well, I suppose times were hard, and the pressure on her, I suppose, was very great. I know she had a very sad the end of her life.
Well, she wrote. One of the things I sent to the library at Gainesville was an article she wrote, and I don't know that she didn't have to write it, but it was, in effect, attacking all of the black authors who were writing about the race problem. And she was saying that this was not what writers should do, and that writers should, that blacks laughed and sang and, you know, lived lives like other human beings, and they should be written about that way, and not as if racial prejudice affected every moment of their lives. Well, of course, it did affect every moment of their lives. I mean, they may have laughed or sung, but the discrimination was, with rare exceptions, reflected in what they sang.
But I guess her point was that they should be seen as three-dimensional individual people. Was that
she was objecting to just bringing racism into the picture, period. She was attacking specifically Richard Wright and other.
Those were her
writers.
Good friends in the beginning, though, weren't they? Langston Hughes, and she was in the Harlem
Renaissance. I knew both of those very well. I spent a lot of time with Richard Wright in Paris, yeah. and Langston Hughes in New York and Atlanta lecturing together. They didn't have that much, you know, they recognized her ability as a folklorist. She wrote, for example, an article for the American Legion magazine, supposedly a documentary thing about how Florida blacks were selling their votes for $2 a piece or something.
Huh.
Well, you know, true or not, it's not the sort of thing you advertise in the American Legion magazine.
No.
So I was never a great admirer of hers except as a folklorist.
Yeah. Which, as I say, she did have a kind of a sad end to her life.
I don't... She was poor, which is sad.
Yeah. Well, she, after writing all these books and things, she never really achieved any lasting fame, and she was a maid in Miami for a wealthy Miami family, and that's she was rediscovered in the 60s, I guess, and she was a maid.
Yeah.
And, you know, family she was working for didn't even know that she could write.
Yeah, well, I'm another good example of that.
Yeah. Well.
Like it, living on Social Security.
Yeah, but.
No pension for writing about human rights.
Oh, that's, well, yeah, I know. No, no retirement benefits for sure, but. Yeah. Although, you do have a beautiful spot here. But she, well, the sad thing was that then she did try, I think, to publish some more, and she just couldn't get anywhere at all. Well, and mm-hmm. then she died pretty much penniless mm-hmm. and no family. She had no family, I guess, mm-hmm. by that time at all. And she was in an unmarked grave, and I think finally somebody raised enough money to get a stone. I think it was a young black woman just only maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I think, I was reading that they finally placed a stone on her grave. But she kind of totally stopped being involved in that.
Yeah. You know, do you know about the novelist Theodore Pratt? His things weren't great, but he was very prolific. He must have written 30 novels with Florida backgrounds.
No.
And one about the Florida Keys called Mercy Island, and he did write The Barefoot Mailman, which was made into a movie, and so he
Acre
worth doing, and it was certainly a folksy historical.
Where does he live,
thing.
Or did he live?
He's now dead, but I've tried to contact his wife recently, and I've turned over all my correspondence with him. He was some 10 years older than I am, and I think thought of me as a sort of protege. He had already had a book or two published when we met, and he was very helpful to me, actually, and pretty good craftsman. He couldn't spell, but he said they had lots of $5,000 a year boys at the publishing houses to correct all that. And,
Did he live in South Florida or
Lake Worth? And
we were just in Lake Worth not too long ago. He wasn't finished, was he?
He's not living, and I don't know. The library, his papers are all at South Atlantic University, so I sent mine there. And used quite a bit. I provided him with a great deal of Florida folk stuff about the Keys and Key West and folk songs. And some of it, Republic Pictures made a film of his Mercy Island, and we had all these Sponger Money songs and whatnot in there.
That's really interesting, because we were just there a couple of weeks ago. We were interviewing people in the, you know, it's a big Finnish community down in Lake Worth. Thousands of Finns. So we were down there to do some collecting of the Finnish community. But is his wife still there?
I don't know. The library didn't know how to reach her.
Oh, I see. But we'll have to try to find some of
his
work.
She may well be around. Theodore Pratt, his wife's name was Jackie. I don't know how she would, if she's in any telephone books thereabouts or the Finnish community. Well, I don't know who would know. Mm-hmm. You would think the library would.
Yeah, well, they would keep up with him and find who he was. Was he working on the writer's project at all? Or...
Just an author. Yeah. He wrote practically a Florida book every year, though.
It kind of makes you wonder, though. I don't know how people find...
The Barefoot Mailman thing, I think, was a valuable little piece of history. I often thought of my Palmetto Country as a sort of barefoot history of Florida, the history of Florida from a barefooted Floridian's point of view.
Yeah,
no big names and dates, just people moving around.
Well, it's the kind of book that you like to read rather than a history book, where, you know, where you really don't care what year Osceola died, but you would like to know the whole story. I don't know if you... Do you know of a man named Will McLean? He's a poet and a songwriter, and I'd say he's in his 60s now. And he, they used to call him the Black Hat Troubadour. He's been, writing songs and poems about Florida for about 20, 30 years. I think he started performing at the Florida Folk Festival almost since its beginning, like 25 years ago he started coming. He's still around and he's still real active in singing, and he's had a few albums out and he's had some books of poetry. And I was just wondering if you had heard.
Where is he?
Well, he travels around. He has a problem. He's an alcoholic. Mm. And so he has a real hard problem. He stays with friends until he can't take it any longer, and he goes off on a binge and then winds up at somebody else's. And he usually stays either in Tampa or Gainesville with friends. And I was just wondering if you had ever heard
I don't
of him.
Recall the name. I just don't know. Yeah. There was a something I had in mind, though, that might be of interest to you. In
yeah.
Key West, a fellow named Mario Sanchez.
Oh.
The carver.
Yeah.
I knew him when he was, he had done a few fishes like these things you see on my wall.
Uh-huh.
And he was carving them out of cedar, I think, and painting them and selling them to bars and restaurants.
Yeah.
But then you do know about his work.
Well, you know, he is now in Tampa. And he is doing kind of like paintings, bas-relief. There was a movie that was done on him called Mario Sanchez, Painter of Memories. And it's an hour-long documentary movie that this company from New York State did, Bowling Green Films. And they came down and did this film on
him. He's an important artist, in my opinion. I saw him after like 30 years. He wanted me to be his advertising PR man back in the beginning when we were both kids.
Uh-huh.
And he was carving fishes. And I saw him again after 30 years recently, you know. And he said, "Well, you're too late," said I just retired.
Oh.
This is the last thing I'm doing, you see, here. And the thing,
oh, did he really retire?
The thing he was doing, I'm afraid so. That's one reason I wanted to call it to your attention, because
bad.
If the state of Florida doesn't have any of his works, they're going mostly to Canada.